Hi, you're listening to the EU China podcast powered by the EU China Hub, straight from Brussels, a show on which we interview important actors in the EU China relations and cover the top EU China news. Our mission is to help you to get a more nuanced picture of what is going on in the EU China relations. My name is Greg Stets, and I'm happy to have you with us. If you like our show, don't forget to subscribe and to tell your friends about us. Let's get started. Hi, here comes the EU China briefing for July 27, 2020. In today's news, we cover EU's update on 5G toolbox implementation and Huawei measures. Towards a coordinated EU response on Hong Kong. Pompeo looks for friends to get hawkish on China. China responds to Pompeo and calls Germany. European Council's consensus on recovery package and way forward. This recording is based on a briefing prepared by Flavian Berniaga and Grzegorz Stets. Enjoy! EU's update on 5G toolbox implementation and Huawei measures. On July 24th, the European Commission released a report on the implementation in member states of the EU Toolbox on 5G cybersecurity. The toolbox, published in January 2020, seeks to address the strategic and technical measures that ought to be taken under account in the building of 5G infrastructure in Europe. It is an attempt to craft a coherent, across-the-union cyber policy on 5G with critical implications for Huawei's future in Europe. The toolbox outlined that member states must take concrete steps to recommend improvements to their 5G strategies by April 30th and prepare a report on their implementation by June 30th. The toolbox involves strategic and technical measures. The former concern the creation of increased regulatory powers for network procurement, while the latter concerns measures to strengthen the security of 5G networks by, quote, addressing the risks arising from technologies, processes, human and physical factors, end of quote. As of May 2020, 12 member states had deployed 5G commercial services, which are for now governed by the EU telecommunication framework. And bear in mind that this framework is quite outdated, as it was adopted in 2002 and last updated in 2009. At the same time, the member states have undertaken steps to enhance coordination between themselves in regard to standardization and developing relevant certification schemes. But what are the key risks that are being targeted here? According to the report, those are misconfiguration of networks, lack of access control, and interference through the 5G supply chain. At least 20 member states consider these issues to be of high or very high importance. And similarly, existing measures were described as insufficient in averting risks related to dependency on a single supplier, state interference in the 5G supply chain, exploitation of the network by organized crime groups, and exploitation of the Internet of Things. But overall, the report argues that most member states have taken steps to implement the toolbox, and they carried out gap analysis and launched processes to review and upgrade existing security measures, as indicated in a very insightful table that we took out from the report, and you can find it on our website. But getting back to the overview, despite the fact that most of member states have taken those steps, still the report also highlights that in some member states, defining the content and scope of measures has been stalled by the lack of political impetus needed to kickstart the process. And moreover, not all member states have shared detailed information about every measure they took. But what does all of this mean for Huawei? Although the words Huawei and China do not appear in the report, there are a few measures that concern the Chinese company, especially the strategic measures number 3, 5, and 6. Let's take a look at them in a little bit more detail. So strategic measure number 3, identifying and applying restrictions for high-risk suppliers. When it comes to the measures aimed at minimizing exposure to high-risk suppliers, 14 member states said their exposure to high-risk suppliers is medium or high, but 8 member states provided no response, many of them stating they lack a framework or a time frame for determining the risk of suppliers. For the 14 member states that said there is a high or medium risk of exposure to high-risk suppliers, the process of dealing with this issue is quite advanced, as they indicated they plan to take into account the origin of suppliers and the risk of interference from third countries. And in order to tackle this issue, the member states must define implementation plans for operators currently using the supplier's equipment, then they must take into account risk factors posed by the suppliers, and then they must rigorously analyze the supplier in question, and based on this analysis, they must exclude them if they present risk for key assets. So it is indeed quite a complex process. And when it comes to strategic measures number 5 and number 6, so ensuring diversity of suppliers and strengthening resilience at national level, most member states have yet to draw plans to address existing dependency on suppliers and to prevent future dependencies. And what does this mean for member states? It implies they must make sure their mobile operators do not depend on a single supplier and that they have a well-thought-out strategy to select multiple 5G vendors. So while 12 member states have work in progress on this topic, only 5 have an implementation plan that ends in 2020. In total, 16 member states lack an implementation timeframe altogether, so further work is needed to clarify what the parameters of such strategies would be. Moving on to the takeaway. According to the report, the strategic measures that Huawei is most interested in are those least addressed by current measures, which shows that the Chinese company is facing a bumpy road ahead. The report also shows the difference in approach between the United States and the EU on addressing the Huawei challenge. The US rhetoric intensive and freedom-loving actions contrast sharply with the EU's low-key, norms-focused approach, a trait that we vouched for already back in January. So this norms-focused approach also is linked to the toolbox itself, which is effectively a set of recommendations and guidelines. But still, the member states who are slow in enforcing 5G cybersecurity reform will be pressured into pursuing it once coordination at the EU level is breathing down their necks. And on top of that comes the recent UK's decision to ban Huawei by 2027, which provided additional political momentum. And we can see, for example, how this plays out in France, where on July 24th, the government announced plans that would amount to a de facto ban on Huawei by 2028. And the measures, for example, stipulate that French mobile operators would be granted licenses with Huawei only for a duration of 3 to 8 years. Towards a coordinated e-response on Hong Kong. On July 24th, more details emerged about an EU-wide coordinated response to the Hong Kong National Security Law. It is expected to be released on Tuesday, July 28. Aside from limiting tech exports that facilitate, quote, internal repression, the interception of internal communications or cyber surveillance, end of quote, the 27 EU leaders also agreed on sanctions, including trade curbs and a review of visa agreements. If released on Tuesday, the response package will have come exactly a week after the Commission's 22nd annual report on Hong Kong, which mentioned, quote, over 136.2 billion euros worth of investment stock and over 2,300 EU companies operating in Hong Kong, end of quote. And reports about how the joint response package could look like coincided with a release of a joint statement by representatives of 10 foreign affairs committees in European Parliament, which called on China to, quote, rethink its decision to impose this law in order to restore the good faith with European nations, end of quote. The 10 committees come from Belgium, Estonia, Luxembourg, Germany, Norway, Denmark, the European Parliament, Latvia, the Netherlands, and the UK. And interestingly, the EU package would come also after the UK has already published the details of its decision to grant Hong Kong BNO holders the opportunity to settle in the UK. And Home Secretary Priti Patel clarified that the proposal does not imply skills tests, minimum income requirements, or caps on numbers. But within this story, we also want to highlight another issue that is also linked to systemic rivalry between EU and China, and that is Xinjiang. So on July 24th, 8 MEPs, most of whom are part of the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, decried the EU has taken few steps to address human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And the MEPs argued, quote, "The EU should demand an UN independent international fact-finding mission," end of quote, and should indicate sanctions against those responsible for abuses in Xinjiang. And this also comes in the context of labor unions and NGOs highlighting that brands operating in Xinjiang are indirectly benefiting from the oppression of Uyghurs. An investigation by New York Times even uncovered that Uyghur forced labor is used in the production of PPE. Moving on to the takeaway. The national security law in Hong Kong has created important political momentum across the EU, and the document, the package that is expected on Tuesday, is a concrete development towards a common EU foreign policy on China, which was facilitated, by the way, once again by Franco-German cooperation. So keep an eye on the announcement of the package and look beyond the measures imposed. The political language surrounding the announcement, as well as the coordination between member states on the matter, will be very important for how the policy will develop further. And the news will surely be followed with interest in Beijing, particularly after Pompeo's calls for a united stance of democracies against China. Pompeo looks for friends to get hawkish on China. In a speech held on July 23rd at the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, of all places, Mike Pompeo called for an end to quote-unquote blind engagement with China. And importantly, the speech came after the Chinese consulate in Houston was ordered closed, which was followed by the retaliatory closing of the US consulate in Chengdu. In his speech, Pompeo, the US Secretary of State, made it clear that he wants to retire engagement policy and revert to a type of containment which was referred to as, quote, "comprehensive, multidimensional, relentlessly objective candor," end of quote. Pompeo tried to make his case by saying, quote, "If we want to have a free 21st century and not the Chinese century of which Xi Jinping dreams, the old paradigm of blind engagement with China simply won't get it done," end of quote. Instead, he offered a much more assertive, even confrontational approach. Quote, "The only way to truly change communist China is to act not on the basis of what Chinese leaders say, but how they behave." And you can see American policy responding to this conclusion. President Reagan said that he dealt with the Soviet Union on the basis of trust, but verify. When it comes to the CCP, I say we must distrust and verify. End of quote. Interestingly, his speech also tried to create a division between the CCP and the Chinese people, whom he described as, quote, "dynamic, freedom-loving people who are completely distinct from the Chinese Communist Party," end of quote. Importantly, beyond that, Pompeo also outlined his vision for, quote-unquote, "free nations" to team up in a coalition to oppose China and, quote, "defend freedom," end of quote. Pompeo acknowledged that not all countries would adopt the same stance, but he argued they should, quote, "start by doing what America has done, to simply insist on reciprocity, to insist on transparency and accountability from the Chinese Communist Party," end of quote. The Secretary of State brought back the Cold War narrative by referring to the USSR and highlighting that, quote, "the CCP is repeating some of the same mistakes that the Soviet Union made, alienating potential allies, breaking trust at home and abroad, rejecting property rights, and predictable rule of law," end of quote, but acknowledged that, quote, "the USSR was closed off from the free world. Communist China is already within our borders," end of quote. Pompeo called on institutions, including the UN and the G20, in which, by the way, China has greater position thanks to US isolationism, to employ, quote, economic, diplomatic, and military power, end of quote, before suggesting that it may be the time for, quote, a new grouping of like-minded nations, a new alliance of democracies, end of quote. In his conclusions, Pompeo said, quote, if the free world doesn't change, communist China will surely change us. There can't be a return to the past practices because they're comfortable or because they're convenient, end of quote. Pompeo also made a call on, among others, Europe, to not, quote, repeat the mistakes of these past years, end of quote. And it's possible that based on past weeks, he's hoping Europe will join the US in deploying a tougher line on China. Just recall, at the end of June, Pompeo said he was on board with an EU-US dialogue on China with a, quote, shared understanding of the threat posed by the CCP, end of quote. And the same line was shown by Pompeo during his state visit to the UK on July 21st with the scope of building a coalition against China. Similarly, on July 13th, Trump sent National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger and Robert O'Brien to meet with European counterparts in the UK, Germany, France, and Italy to discuss the West's competition with China. And just recall that one of the core elements of Jens Stoltenberg's vision for NATO 2030, presented on June 8, was responding to the security challenges associated with China's rise. So NATO may also be an important medium through which Pompeo could seek recruits. Moving to the takeaway, there's one problem here. The question is, who's buying it? Pompeo's speech may sound inspiring to China hawks and those fed up with Beijing's recent actions, but it is based on rather shaky assumptions. The first one is that the Chinese people at large hope for regime change. And this is not accurate, as the party's legitimacy has been fueled both by improved standard of living and by nationalistic rhetoric that has an opportunity to grow every time anti-China rhetoric comes out of Washington. Another flawed assumption is that the US can easily assemble a Cold War-like team of countries to stand up to China, especially after 3 years during which the Trump administration went after most of the US major allies. Also, the freedom and values card may not be that convincing given the deployment of federal forces against civilians participating in Black Lives Matter protests, the detention camps at the border with Mexico, and the repeated spreading of disinformation by the president, who also doesn't favor multilateral, rule-based solutions in international relations. So this narrative that Pompeo put forward may be hard to sustain. So in Europe, Pompeo's speech will most likely resonate with countries that are heavily dependent on NATO, but his decision to nitpick on Germany may not end up being helpful, as we outline in the next news bite. But Foreign Policy China Bureau Chief James Palmer suggested that the speech may actually be aimed at Beijing. So in his interpretation, Pompeo would like for Beijing to retaliate on US businesses, giving White House hawks more decoupling ammunition. However, the fact that China retaliated by closing a similarly sized consulate, Chengdu, shows that Beijing is calculating strategically its next steps. And that may not last long, though, because the nationalistic rhetoric cited above is a gunpowder keg that is difficult to control, and Xi Jinping has made excessive use of it since coming to power. China responds to Pompeo and calls Germany. The Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs reacted to Pompeo's speech on July 24th. MFA spokesperson Wang Webin characterized Pompeo's speech as being, quote, full of ideological prejudice and a Cold War mindset, end of quote. Wang Webin also accused Pompeo of wanting to, quote, deflect attention with slanders against and oppression of China and score some political gains, end of quote. Wang also rejected claims of a gap between the CCP and the Chinese people by citing a policy brief by the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation at Harvard University, which argues that Chinese people's satisfaction with the Chinese government is over 93%. Further, Wang said Beijing is, quote, committed to developing a China-US relationship featuring non-conflict, non-confrontation, end of quote, but he also called on the US government to discard its Cold War mindset. The retaliation also featured a generous use of Xi Jinping's slogans, as it talked about China being committed to an, quote, independent foreign policy of peace, the path of peaceful development, a new type of international relations, and a community with a shared future for mankind, end of quote. Wang Weibin also tried to downplay the possibility of an anti-China international coalition, saying that the US administration's, quote, petty tricks cannot fool the American people and the international community, end of quote. Moving on to a more concrete case, so the case of Germany, which was indirectly targeted by Pompeo, who referred to it as a NATO ally which, quote, hasn't stood up in the way that it needs to with respect to Hong Kong, end of quote. So just mere hours after the speech, Heiko Maas and Wang Yi held a phone call in which the Chinese Minister of Foreign Affairs argued that no country with an independent will shall join forces with the US in its calls for decoupling. However, the two readouts of the conversation are not the same. The Chinese one says the two talked about cooperation on a COVID-19 vaccine and a comprehensive agreement on investment, but did not mention Hong Kong. The German one said they talked about Hong Kong, comprehensive agreement on investment, 5G, and the conflicts in Libya and Iran. And according to those readouts, Maas stuck to the official EU narrative on China, calling it an, quote, important partner, but also a competitor and a systemic rival, end of quote. And he stressed that it is, quote, crucial that we stay in dialogue, especially on critical issues, end of quote. Moving to the takeaway. While EU circles may not necessarily be overwhelmed with joy at the prospect of working with Pompeo and Trump, the mood in Brussels is surely shifting. In a recent interview with Der Spiegel, High Representative Josep Borrell said, quote, we are not just discovering today that China is a communist country with an authoritarian regime. What is new is that Beijing now sees itself as a world power and is acting as such. The West was naive with regard to China. We thought that with increasing trade, there would be change, end of quote. But Germany stands as the pillar of the EU's relationship with China. More specifically, Beijing is interested in maintaining good relations with Angela Merkel, who has been committed to maintaining stable economic ties with China, which has recently attracted plenty of criticism, as we argued in a past briefing. However, China is playing on borrowed time here, because Merkel's time as a chancellor is coming to an end in 2021, and we highly recommend an article by South China Morning Post Stuart Lau, which you can find linked on our website. But there is also an even broader problem here, which is exactly what we argued at the beginning of June. So Beijing is betting on maintaining the status quo that it has enjoyed for the past years, but it does not suggest any reframing of current tensions. And if maintained, such an approach is doomed to fail, as the narrative no longer has salience for China's partners. European Council's consensus on recovery package and way forward. On July 20, following 5 days of marathon negotiations, the 27 heads of state and government of the EU reached a deal on the Next Generation EU and a multi-annual financial framework for 2021-2027. It is a historic deal as it doubles the EU's budget and, more importantly, allows the EU to assume debt in order to finance its deficit spending. So when we left off last week, negotiations had been in a deadlock for 4 days, as leaders disagreed on the size of the package and on single country veto powers over disbursement. Eventually, the European Council agreed on a 1,074 billion euros EU budget for 2021-2027 and to maintain the 750 billion threshold for the recovery fund, albeit split between 360 billion euros in loans and 390 billion in grants. And for context, the Commission's initial proposal suggested $500 billion in grants and $250 billion in loans. The real win here, nonetheless, is that the EU will be able to borrow money on the markets with a long repayment deadline, up to 2058, thus creating a market in EU debt, and maybe even sowing the seeds for a future reserve currency. And to repay the debt, the EU will inevitably levy more taxes. These would be common taxes, amounting to a stepping stone towards a more integrated common fiscal union. The deal was warmly welcomed by its main designers, Merkel, Macron, von der Leyen and Michel, and generally all leaders, including the Frugals, were content with the results, although Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said the deal shouldn't be called historic. But questions still hover over two important topics. How are the governance of disbursements and the conditionality of the rule of law going to be interpreted? The portion of the fund that comprises grants is tied to commitment by member states to pursue reform, and it was a main frugal condition for compromise. And countries must establish targets and make progress towards them if they want to see the money. But the final deal stipulates that, quote, no commission decision on the approval of payments will be taken until the next European Council has exhaustively discussed the matter. So the way exhaustively is interpreted here will be defining for the grants disbursement process. Also, it appears that leaders left Brussels with ambiguous language on the rule of law. They argued that, quote, a regime of conditionality to protect the budget and the next generation EU will be introduced. In this context, the Commission will propose measures in case of breaches for adoption by the Council by qualified majority, end of quote. And both Hungary and Poland claimed victory on this topic. But if qualified majority vote will be used instead of unanimity, that leaves Hungary and Poland without a blocking minority in the European Council. And von der Leyen herself stated the reference to qualified majority vote shows the bloc's clear commitment to the rule of law. And on top of all that comes the European Parliament, because the European Council may have reached consensus, but the legislative train has not reached its destination yet. The next station is going to be the European Parliament. And on July 23rd, the European Parliament issued a press release in which it called the agreement a historical move, but said, quote, the cuts to the long-term budget are unacceptable, end of quote. As such, it threatened to not approve the multi-annual financial framework's proposal if a new agreement is not reached, one that would increase EU sources of revenue and would link EU funding to the rule of law. Moving to the takeaway. It's not the time to pop the champagne yet. Now that the dust has settled on the tense negotiations, it is good to outline the big winners, but also to outline the negotiations ahead. The outcome is a reward for Emmanuel Macron's efforts in the past 3 years to crystallize his vision for Europe into something more concrete. It is also a step forward for Angela Merkel's legacy building, and it is also a win for Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel, who work to facilitate the most important outcome achieved by EU heads since Jacques Delors' proposal for the euro and the single market. But do not get overly excited. Even before the European Council, the Parliament said it sees the Commission proposal as the bare minimum, as we outlined last week. Now the Parliament has made it even clearer that it won't rubber stamp the European Council's decision, and that it expects the EU to gain more own resources, which is Brussels lingo for sources of revenue, and also that it wants a comprehensive link between how the money is sent and a commitment to the rule of law. In this last regard, it definitely does not help that one day after Viktor Orbán returned from the summit, the editor of Hungary's largest media outlet was fired, and this led to more than 80 journalists resigning in Budapest, which once again increased concerns about Hungary's freedom of press. So, long story short, though the initial agreement is a concrete point of reference for future negotiations, we still have a long way to go until it is all ratified. And that's it for this week's briefing. See you next time. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the EU-China podcast. If you want to know more or to get in touch with us, visit our website, which is euchinahub.com. And if you find this show insightful, be sure to leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice. It will help others to get to know about us. See you next time.